that'll do it for Have You Heard? And The Breakfast Bar. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And stay tuned for our news and public affairs show, The Surreal News. We have a special show coming up today. Don't touch that dial. A packed special show. All right, we're so glad that you joined us this morning. My name is Steve Norris. This is a WSLR News and Public Affairs show, and my co-host is Lou Larini. Lou, I'm just so psyched. Tell us about our first guest, and then tell us about our second guest.
I am too, Steve. This is really, no joke about it. This is going to be a very important, great show. Our first guest is going to be a fellow named Christopher Hill, who has written a book called The Outpost. He was, a long-time State Department employee, was ambassador to Iraq and,
Macedonia, Poland,
and a bunch of other places. And, his book is great, and I think he's going to give us some serious insight into, the how and the why of U.S. foreign policy.
He's also coming here to Bookstore One in the Saner Pavilion at New College, and he's going to be on our show, and then he'll be in town next week. All right, that's our first show.
That's our first guest. That's right.
You don't want to miss that. All right, who's next?
Well, our second guest, we're coming a little closer to home, is an author from Louisiana who has written a book called The Axes of Evil, not to be confused with The Axis of Evil, and his book is sort of a solution to a whodunit. Turn of the century, some very horrific graphic murders that were committed, that were basically not really solved, and he has his own theory of who actually committed these crimes, that were just... I'll let him tell you about it. It was just insane, Steve. Just crazy.
We get these surreal author books, and this is another one.
Yeah.
We want to thank Booth Media for that. All right. We have some surreal news, as we usually do, and you're going to start with some news about, Florida news.
I know everybody.
It's never good.
I know everybody has heard this. The Florida part of it, okay, which you can't get any more surreal than this.
Global dying.
That Florida is one of the states perhaps most susceptible to the effects of climate change, global dying, and sea level rise. But the governor has verbally banned state environmental officials from using the term climate change.
You can't say that.
You can't say climate change. An investigation has revealed. But the Sunshine State isn't the only state in the United States to try to attempt to outlaw, and it's in quotes, climate science. North Carolina, Louisiana, and Tennessee have all passed laws that attempt to cast doubt on established climate science in boardrooms and classrooms. The reality of climate science due to human activity has been widely accepted by climate scientists. As a matter of fact, one we had on the show just recently, Jeff Chanton. And some experts worry that attempts to deny the science could prevent states from preparing for sea level rise, extreme weather, and other effects of a warming planet. In an investigation published March 8th, the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting found evidence of an unwritten policy that banned officials in the state's Department of Environmental Protection from using specific terms related to climate change. That's amazing.
Yeah, the other related stories, Kerry came out and said that that this is crazy that Florida is doing this. So we have our
Governor Rick Scott's answer whenever anybody asks him this in a press conference says, "I'm not a scientist. I don't know."
Yeah, but he knows how to censor them.
That's right. So I guess even scientists aren't scientists, or if they are, they aren't allowed to say what they want to say.
Yeah, and we had on our show one of the scientists that met with him. I wonder he would say about
that.
All right. A little bit underreported is that the U.S. is close to its debt limit.
Again?
Dangerously close. And that's March 16th. And according to Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, we are increasingly dangerously close. So the debt limit does not authorize new spending commitments, but just allows the government to pay its expenditures Congress has already approved. It's a short story, sort of underreported here. But once again, we have our failure of the government just to do the nuts and bolts thing to keep the lights on. Can't seem to be able to do that.
Yeah, you know, it isn't any big deal, I guess, that we are exceeding our debt limit, because that seems to happen every time. But yes, the fact that it is underreported might be a good sign, because nobody's basically rattling sabers in Congress saying that, we aren't going to approve an increase, you know, unless President Obama does this or somebody does something. I guess they can't blame the Senate anymore.
All right, we're going to move on because we got lots of stuff to cover.
Yes,
this
we do.
This great science story you're going to tell us about, basically an artificial leaf. So how can we do photosynthesis in the lab now?
Well, that's what it essentially is. I mean, artificial photosynthesis is closer to creating fuel. You know, solar and wind power have one thing in common besides being renewable. When the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, they don't generate electricity. But artificial photosynthesis may someday help change that. Battery storage is being developed as a way to feed the renewable power onto the power grid, regardless of the weather or the time. To lessen reliance on carbon-emitting fossil fuels, some scientists are looking to plants and trees for another solution using a man-made leaf that can turn solar energy into fuel in the form of liquid sugars and carbohydrates. In nature, plants, of course, use the energy from the sun to convert it into chemical energy to be used later. Scientists at Caltech think they have discovered a missing link in the development of the artificial version of that process, and they published it this week in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. There are a lot of things we should be doing today that if we really wanted to lower carbon emissions, we'd do, Nate Lewis, a professor of chemistry at Caltech and co-author of the paper, said. This isn't one of those. This is a bridge. If you want to bring on renewables, you've got to find a way to store carbon-free power, and you've got to get high-energy density transportation fuels carbon neutral. We have to be ready with technology that can do both of these things. And artificial photosynthesis is the leading candidate for that job. So, you know, this leaf, even though I didn't get into the technical parts of
You mean the nickel oxide coating they're using to separate the hydrogen and the oxygen, which are produced, which otherwise would explode, and they have a plastic type of membrane, and they're using pressure to get the hydrogen out so it doesn't explode?
You mean that part.
That type of stuff?
We'll
skip over that.
Well, you know, I just think the whole idea of photosynthesis is, like, really cool, and that if somebody can find a way to, you know, learn from nature to create, something that's already there, you know, and could really, you're right. These guys are right. I mean, could solve our whole energy problem, because it's obviously carbon neutral, because it eats up carbon dioxide gas.
Yeah, take lessons from nature.
There you go.
These hydrogen cells make energy. Okay.
All right.
All right, let's talk about homeopathy, and I know there are some big fans of homeopathy out there. Some of our biggest supporters of this show believe in homeopathy, but according to an Australian report, top medical researcher says that homeopathy does not work. And may put people at risk if they reject or delay treatment. So homeopathy, according to the study, is not effective for treating any health condition. And this comes out of Australia's top body for medical research that's concluded. All right, so homeopathy, the basis here is they believe that illness-causing substances can, in minute doses, treat people who are unwell. So what you do is you dilute substances in water or alcohol, and homeopaths claim that the mixture retains a memory of the original substance and triggers a healing response in the body. And I know people will swear that this helps. The claims have been widely disproven with multiple studies, and the National Health and Medical Research Council in Australia has for the first time thoroughly reviewed lots of papers on this, over 200 papers, and released it and said that there's no evidence of effectiveness of homeopathy, that there are no health conditions for which there is reliable evidence that homeopathy is effective, according to this report. All right, the report goes on. We're not going to get into a lot of details because we have other stuff to report here. This is the news here. This is our science news. All right, where would you like to go next? Are you going to go back in time? What's your next
No, actually, I think we're going to stay in Florida because there is that okay. one story that is it does fall into the category of only in Florida for a couple of reasons. One, I guess the headline says it all, Florida man drove dead body to attorney's office. Florida detectives are investigating the case of a man who drove to his lawyer's office with a dead body in the bed of his pickup truck, authorities said Thursday. John Marshall, 52, here's the Florida part, said he shot his neighbor in self-defense during a scuffle involving a gun. The lawyer reported that the death of the 65-year-old Theodore Hubble, according to Lee County Sheriff's Office, which said it had not made any arrests. The two men are neighbors in Boquilla, a community of about 2,000 people on Pine Island, southwest Florida. Marshall was taken to the hospital with facial wounds and possibly broken thumbs. Harris told, Robert Harris, the attorney, told, the news press of Fort Myers that Marshall had called him days earlier saying he feared for his safety. It was not clear why the men were fighting, but the fact that he put the body in the back of his pickup truck and drove to his lawyer rather than call somebody. And the other element, which is very Florida, is that it was an argument over a gun where somebody got shot. And I would bet everybody had their carry permits. I mean, I'm sure the gun was completely legal.
Yeah.
So it's like they aren't dangerous at all. I mean, aren't as dangerous as axes, I guess.
All right, well, let's go the opposite way. No guns here. We're talking about the Dalai Lama. And now, a conflict with China. So the China is ordering the Dalai Lama to reincarnate. What? What's going on here? All right, so what's going on here is that the Chinese Communist Party leaders are really afraid that the Dalai Lama will not have an afterlife. That's the point of this story. So they're worried and warning that he must reincarnate and on their terms. So tensions about what's going to go on after the 14th Dalai Lama dies and who's going to decide who will succeed him as the most prominent leader in Tibetan Buddhism. And now it's ignited a big controversy at the annual gathering of China's leaders in Beijing. So then China came back and said the decision-making power over the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama and over the end of survival of the lineage resides in the central government of China, of course. And they've ordered him to reincarnate. All right, so we'll see what's going to go on there. We love these Dalai Lama stories here about some tension there with China. Any comments on that?
Well, I don't know, a bureaucratic response to, a totally spiritual matter seems to be kind of amusing how they can sort of mandate or think they can mandate who the reincarnated Dalai Lama is going to be. I mean, isn't that something that is, beholden to like a much higher force?
Yeah, and the tensions with Tibet, too.
Really.
All that stuff.
I know.
All right, so we have, don't touch that dial, we have our great guest ambassador, former ambassador of Iraq and Macedonia and Poland, Chris Hill, is coming up in just a minute. Well, in just a Media Matters minute. Don't touch that dial.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Laura Keeter. Conservative media figures are praising 47 Republican senators for signing an open letter to Iranian leaders in an attempt to undercut the Obama administration's nuclear negotiations with Iran. Here's radio host Laura Ingraham praising Senator Tom Cotton, who wrote the letter.
Tom Cotton is doing the right thing on both immigration and on Iran because Tom Cotton realizes the threat to the homeland exists in many forms.
On Fox and Friends, co-host Brian Kilmeade was also supportive.
You have a war veteran who just became senator, says, I got to put my name on something and let them know the president isn't the absolute monarch of our country.
But experts say that the letter may be an unprecedented breach of foreign policy protocol, both in its form and its boldness. And according to the Daily Beast, even some Republicans who signed on to the letter are now realizing that it was a bad call. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Well, we want to thank Media Matters for supplying us with that audio. And let me just remind people, Media Matters is a nonprofit out of Washington, D.C. that does supply us with that audio. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. This is News and Public Affairs in Sarasota, Florida, Surreal News Show, your weapon of mass instruction. And I'm delighted to have on our show, our guest is former ambassador or Ambassador Chris Hill. Good morning, Ambassador Hill.
Good morning.
And Ambassador is getting up early this morning. Thank you for getting up so early, your time to join us. He's written a new book, which is a memoir of one of our most distinguished ambassadors. He has a career of service to the country, to some of the most dangerous outposts in American diplomacy, from the wars in Balkans, the brutality of North Korea, endless war in Iraq, the real life of an American diplomat. He was involved in the front lines of Balkans and the breakup of Yugoslavia, involved with the Dayton Conference. He also was in the Peace Corps in Cameroon early in his career. He was the first American ambassador to Macedonia. He was ambassador to Poland. He also served during the Cold War. He's ambassador to South Korea. We're going to talk about that, about the disarmament of negotiator with North Korea, and handpicked ambassador to Iraq. Thank you so much for joining our show. Good morning to you.
Morning. It's a pleasure.
All right. So there are many ways we could go here, and I certainly want to ask you about just how it is to be an ambassador in general, and we've had some things in the news, but we have some late-breaking news about a letter which was written by some Republicans about what's going on with our negotiations with Iran. And I want to ask you, as an ambassador, your views about this letter which was written to the head of Iran.
Yeah, well, I can tell you it's fairly unusual, and I think to some extent it reflects a couple of things. One is just the severe gap in our country right now between the Republican Congress and the Democratic president, and the fact that they just can't seem to find a common language on anything. So it reflects this sort of broader and deeper polarization that's going on. But I think it also reflects something else, and to some extent it's a misunderstanding among some of the people who signed this letter, which is that when you reach an agreement with a country like Iran on these nuclear negotiations, it's essentially a political agreement. It's not a treaty. And so I think what they are objecting to is the fact that the agreement is not coming to the Senate for so-called ratification as you would a treaty. And so I think to make their point, they've written to the Ayatollah in Iran to say, look, anything agreed, I mean, we can undo with a stroke of a pen in the future. I don't think it's very helpful. I don't think it looks very organized of us, and I think it looks very divided and ultimately very weak. And it's one thing to have the Congress send the president letters objecting to what he's doing, or perhaps pass a so-called non-binding resolution, which is called a sense of the Congress, which might be that we don't like what you're doing with Iran. But to send a letter to a foreign leader is a little unusual, to put it mildly.
Thanks for your opinion there. Again, we're listening to Ambassador Chris Hill. He was the ambassador to Iraq. Let's go to Iraq for a minute here. And we have late-breaking news into Crete that the Iraqi government, with Shia and Sunni kind of united against ISIS, has had some success there. So comment on this and the possible implications in the area.
Well, no question that on the battlefield, the momentum has shifted, and I think it's fair to say that ISIS is kind of back on their heels. Obviously, there's a long way to go, so I wouldn't call it the beginning of the end, but certainly the end of the beginning. And I think we can see that the Kurdish forces in the north have kind of stabilized their position, and the much maligned Iraqi army is performing better. There are a couple of concerns, though. One is, first of all, not to count out ISIS, and already they're making trouble in other parts of western Iraq. They are truly an extremist Sunni group that is very much ideologically focused, and they're not going to just give up. The second thing that is a little worrisome is the fact that within that Iraqi army, there are a lot of these Shia militia groups. Now, these Shia militia groups have traditionally received a lot of help from the Iranians and not very helpful to us. And moreover, the concern is that once they move into these Sunni areas, albeit liberating them from ISIS, the question is how are they going to treat the Sunni population, and will these Shia militia groups behave themselves? Because if they don't, and if there's a conclusion among these Sunni communities that, boy, ISIS may have been bad, but it was better than having these Shia here, then I think we're in for another round of problems. So some cautionary tales as this issue goes on. Finally, I'd like to say that even though I am cautiously optimistic that we're going to be able to push ISIS back and maybe even out of Iraq, the real question is what's going to happen in Syria, where it's never been a question of the good versus the bad, but usually the bad versus the worse, and we've got to find somebody to back and some kind of governance solutions for the future. So a pretty tough row to hoe ahead.
When you were ambassador to Iraq under Clinton, going back to 2010, did you see any of this coming with ISIS, and were there any clues? We didn't hear about this in the news back then.
Well, certainly, if you go back to the fact that there was a Sunni insurgency in Iraq back in 2006, 2007, and essentially what happened was these very radical Sunnis, unhappy with the fact that the U.S. had invaded Iraq and essentially created a situation where Shia, for the first time in centuries, were in charge of Baghdad, you knew that these Sunnis were not going to be very, very happy about that outcome. And the Shia didn't treat them well. I mean, there wasn't a lot of sort of outreach to the Sunni community. I think the Americans, we certainly did our part, but the Sunnis really felt that they were being pushed out of power and not welcomed into any new system. If you think of how Nelson Mandela handled the white South Africans, you know, reaching out to them and making sure that they felt a part of South Africa's future, the Shia did not do the same with the Sunnis, who are only 20% of the of Iraq, but who nonetheless have ruled the place for years, often with authoritarian governments such as Saddam Hussein. So we did have some success with the Sunnis, but we never really were able to, you know, bring them into the governing structure of the country and make them comfortable working alongside, in some cases, under the Shia. So we knew there were problems, but the issue really came back with a vengeance, mainly because we have a situation in Syria that is out of control, and that situation in Syria I don't think was ever anticipated, certainly not when I was there in 2010.
All right, again, this is Ambassador Chris Hill. He is coming to town here to Sarasota. Thank you. March 17th at the Sarasota Herald Tribune is sponsoring you at the Saner Pavilion. And then the 19th, that's Thursday, at Bookstore One here in Sarasota. And we encourage people to come and listen to you live while you're here in town. And we appreciate you doing that. I'd like to go now to North Korea, where you spent some time there with some of the negotiations. And we're talking about your new book, Outposts, and quite a bit about your new book is on North Korea, correct? And there was
The book's about 400 pages, and I'd say upwards of 100 pages is about my work on the Korean Peninsula, in particular my work with other countries in trying to get the North Koreans to give up their nuclear ambitions.
All right, so there's a question I've been dying to ask all my guests all these years, which is basically, you know, how did we fail and allow the North Koreans to get the nuclear material? And what was going on in Pyongyang, and what was going on with Cheney behind the scenes, and what's your opinion on how that came down?
Well, the first thing to understand is North Koreans, who are frankly not the most likable people in the world. I mean, these are people only a mother can love, believe me. They have had these nuclear ambitions for several decades. This didn't just start in the Bush administration. This went back several decades. So they have had a long-standing desire to make nuclear weapons and basically to use nuclear weapons to kind of get a shortcut to what they believe to be sort of world power status. So they have this real ambition. You know, these are Korean people, and, you know, there's a lot of talent there. And so even though the country is hideously poor and awfully run, I mean, in terms of this terrible dictatorship that it has. So the problem has been how to keep them from doing that and how to disabuse them from it. Now, the U.S., I think under President Bush sat down with the Chinese president, and President Bush said, look, we, America, cannot solve this problem on our own. We need your help. We need the help of the South Koreans, the help of the Japanese, the Russians. And so there was an effort to put together something called a six-party talks, which were aimed at kind of ganging up on the North Koreans and telling them, you know, this is unacceptable. We made some progress with the North Koreans. We got them to shut down their plutonium plant. We got them to disable that plant. But we were ultimately not able to get back the material that they've already produced for making nuclear weapons, nor were we able to stop their effort to produce nuclear weapons through another means, and that is the so-called uranium enrichment means. You know, countries usually use two different things. One is plutonium, the other is uranium enrichment. So the problem is still very much out there. The good news is the U.S. and South Korea are working very closely together on it, and that's not always been the case. And also the good news is I think China is increasingly seized with the need to do something about this. You know, China has aided and abetted North Korea over the years, but really the Chinese have kind of had it with them. So it's a situation that needs a lot of work in the future, but there has been some progress.
On somewhat of a lighter note, there was a movie called The Interview, which came out, which I saw. Seth Rogen was in it. Comments?
Yeah, I saw it twice. Seth Rogen is pretty funny in it. There's some great lines in it. I watched it more out of solidarity with Sony than anything else. I think the North Koreans need to understand that as long as they pursue these policies that they have with this almost hideously comical figures they have running that country, that they're going to be the brunt of a lot of Hollywood satire. That's just life when you choose to behave the way they behave.
All right, very good. Once again, this is Ambassador Chris Hill. We're almost coming up to half past the hour here. And I guess what I wanted to do is ask you a little bit about things going on now in China and our relationship with them and some comments in that part of the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, China is a country of some 1.4 billion people. It's been around for about 4,000 years. I'm sure it'll be around for another 4,000 years. And I think it behooves us to find some patterns of cooperation, to use an expression that Condoleezza Rice used. It behooves us to find these patterns of cooperation, figure out a way forward with China. I mean, our relationship with them is not going to be easy. It'll always be characterized by a certain note of competition, and sometimes even a little conflict, along with cooperation. But, you know, it is a relationship that we have with an important country, and I would put that relationship in the category of too big and too important to fail. And so we have to work on it every day. Not easy because, frankly, China does not share our values. China has, you know, they have an internal system which most Americans would find awful. But we need to find a way forward with that very important country.
All right, I want to get just a little bit more about you personally. And you started out in the Peace Corps. You were a volunteer in Cameroon.
Yeah,
a little bit about some of your experiences there.
Yeah, that was interesting. In those days, you know, you're in college, you're not sure what you're going to do next. By the time I graduated in college, the draft was over. It was in 1974, so I made the decision to serve my country by joining the Peace Corps, and they sent me out to the middle of West Africa, a little country called Cameroon, and my job was to go around these rural areas and helped them with these little tiny banks they had. Really, they were credit unions. And I strapped an adding machine on the back of my motorcycle and kind of audited the books. I was sort of a bank auditor. And occasionally I'd find loan concentrations and, you know, too many loans among too few people. And I'd call out people on it and learned a lot about how to supervise situations. I learned a lot about how people do respect America and listen to things we say. I also learned a lot about the need to be a little humble and not assume that you understand everything, because even societies that are poor and destitute can be very complex societies, and you need to respect the complexity. So I always tell people, you know, my favorite Foreign Service job was serving as a volunteer in the Peace Corps. I think it's a bit of a, you know, I'm bothered when people somehow think you have to be an ambassador to make a difference. I mean, most of my career I was not an ambassador, and certainly I was nothing close to that when I was out there in the middle of a camera room. So I think you can do a lot just being an American citizen and showing respect to other people and being willing to listen to them.
All right, we're speaking to, again, this is Ambassador Chris Hill. His new book is Outpost, Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy, which is currently available. And again, he's going to be in town here Tuesday, March 17th. The Sarasota Herald Tribune editor is going to speak with you about that. And that's going to be at the Saner Pavilion, which is here at New College, which is right next to us here at WSLR. And then also on the 19th, you're going to be at Bookstore One to speak as well. And speaking about sort of your personal experience in face-to-face, how does it feel to be face-to-face with a dictator like Milosevic? And how do you feel when you're doing that?
Yeah, it's not much fun. And you have to kind of check your personal opinions at the door. And I think you have to be very focused on what it is you want to accomplish with these people. So I think it's very necessary to talk to these people. I think when we don't talk to them, they just talk to their advisors who are telling them everything they want to hear. And so when we eventually do have to talk to them, they are so way out there in terms of their views that it takes a while just to bring them back to, you know, planet Earth and explain the reality of the situation. So it was very important to talk to them. And, you know, as with anyone you're trying to influence, you kind of have to be close. I mean, you can't sit there and, you know, be shaking your finger at them and otherwise being a person that they'd rather not see. So you have to manage to keep the door open. And that's the real rub of the whole situation. And that's why, you know, when you see these terrible people and have to deal with them, and then others say, well, how can he go see them? He must like seeing them or something. And then you're fighting these kinds of, you know, people at your rear, you know, coming after you. Not a very pleasant circumstance. And, you know, often, you know, you're very conflicted and you're thinking, you know, why am I doing this? I mean, if no one appreciates what I'm doing. So it's a tough job, frankly speaking.
Wow. And talking about appreciating what you're doing, you also were working under Condoleezza Rice, who you have a lot of respect for in your book. And then also at that same time, some conflicts with Cheney, who we've criticized on this show a time or two. How was it working with somebody? And tell us some of your criticisms on Cheney and how it was to have some conflicts with the Vice President of the United States.
My criticism was the tendency to go to like-minded people outside the government and complain about what Secretary Rice and I were doing. It seems to me if you're the vice president, you have a fairly short distance to the Oval Office, and you can sit down with the president and say, you know, I don't like what Secretary Rice and, you know, what's his name are up to in North Korea, Mr. President. I think you ought to change that policy. And then they can have a discussion about it rather than I have clearly the president wanting Secretary Rice and me to continue doing this, and then Cheney being upset that he basically lost his argument with the president. So how to put it, I think it's a little over my pay grade. And so I do object to that kind of thing. I think, you know, when you have a deputy, a vice, you need to be, you know, that vice or that deputy needs to be absolutely loyal to you. And even if he disagrees with what it is you want to do, he ought to be able to support it because you're the boss. And I felt sometimes Cheney didn't quite understand that relationship.
All right. It's been about 5 years since you've been ambassador to Iraq. And I'd like your comments on the current administration with Obama and the direction that things are going now. So sort of step back and give us your critique.
Well, you know, these are tough issues. I mean, if they weren't tough issues, they wouldn't be around there for so many years. They're just plain tough issues. I hate to be, you know, critical of my successors or critical of my predecessors, but, you know, diplomacy is a kind of relationship game. You have to kind of get close to people and understand that they don't want to do the things you want them to do. Therefore, I think it behooves our president, behooves some of his team to maybe do a little better job of sort of reaching out to people and being a little closer to them in the hopes that you can be more influential. And I think we need to be a little careful when we have some of our senior officials using things like social media, because, you know, if you're a prime minister, an embattled prime minister out there, and then you hear people in Washington criticizing you, the first instinct is not necessarily to give in to them. It's quite the opposite. So I think this administration has had a kind of hard time getting its rhythm and figuring out how to work with these people and how to kind of carry the day in terms of our influence. All that said, for anyone who counts out the United States, who thinks we're in a period of decline or something, I would insist that they tell me who is going to replace us, because I don't see anyone out there, any country out there, that has nearly the kind of influence we do. I don't see any country out there that looks like it's in a position to eclipse the United States. And so whether we like it or not, we're kind of it for the time being. And I would like to see us all kind of do a better job of coming together and working together on some of these tough problems.
Do you think ISIS is the top of the list as a global problem that you think we need to come together to solve?
I think it's up there. I think ISIS, you know, I'm not sure ISIS is a world threat, but it's certainly a regional threat. I mean, their goal is not just to hold on to parts of the Iraqi and Syrian desert. I mean, their goal is much more ambitious in the Middle East, and I don't think we can live with a thing like that. So I think we have to be prepared for this struggle, and I think the president has laid it out very accurately. I think we need to be engaged. We need to kind of create a coalition against these people. So I would put that kind of up there, but I would put these nuclear wannabes up there as well. I don't think we can allow a situation where Iran has a nuclear weapon or continue to allow a situation where North Korea thinks they can get away with nuclear weapons. So I put nuclear proliferation right up there as well. You know, if Iran succeeds with this, there will be a Saudi bomb and other bombs. So I think we really need to struggle with that. But I think what we also need to do is back home, and to be sure, our economy always needs some work. We always need to improve the economy, but we're not doing too badly compared to other countries. Where I think we really need to pick up the pace is in terms of kind of developing a little more political consensus within this country about some of these foreign policy issues. You know, there used to be this quaint notion that politics stops at the water's edge. Well, sometimes now you get the impression politics just gets going at the water's edge. So I think we need to do a much better job of coming together, pulling together, and projecting an image of strength in the world.
All right, Ambassador Chris Hill, he was most recently the ambassador of Iraq, also Macedonia and Poland and others. He has been described as the smartest diplomat ever, and I'm thinking maybe that's right here. You've done many other things, too.
I don't think that.
And also modest, so let's throw that in there, too. And his new book is Outpost, Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy, which is already available. He's going to be here March 17th at the Sainter Pavilion, and then March 19th, Thursday, at Bookstore One. And we want to thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. All right, we hope you enjoyed Ambassador Chris Hill joining us. He got up very early. He's out west to join us this morning and just take apart all of diplomacy in one interview.
That was an incredible interview. I enjoyed that very much. That was great.
All right, we have time for just another Media Matters Minute, and then we're going to get to something really surreal. Axis. That's Axis of Evil.
Minute, I'm John Whitehouse. During Hillary Clinton's press conference addressing her decision to use a personal email account for government work when she became Secretary of State, Clinton said, quote,
I opted for convenience to use my personal email account, which was allowed by the State Department, because I thought it would be easier to carry just one device for my work and for my personal emails instead of two. Looking back, it would have been better if I simply used a second email account and carried a second phone, but at the time, this didn't seem like an issue.
On Fox News, The Five, co-host Eric Bolling accused her of lying.
Are you kidding? Any 10th grader can set up multiple email accounts on a single handheld device.
But according to the tech website Mashable, it was not possible at the time to have two accounts on a secure BlackBerry like the one Clinton carried without granting IT complete access to the phone's data. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Okay, pretty soon we'll be hearing from Todd Elliott, hopefully, but right now, you know, I know that I promised my cat that I would have a cat story every week, but there wasn't a cat story, but there was a dog story. The world's biggest dog show was thrust into a murder mystery fit for an Agatha Christie novel when a champion Irish setter died after its owner said it had been fed steak laced with poison. The death of 3-year-old Jagger rocked Britain's Crufts show, held annually since the reign of Queen Victoria, and unnerved a dog-showing world that some fear may have just become a little too competitive. D. Milligan Bolt, co-owner of Jagger, whose pedigree name was Thedera Satisfaction, said an autopsy had concluded that he had eaten steak laced with several types of poison that led to a painful death for the dog on his return to Belgium. It's pretty bad. She called on fellow breeders to track down the poisoner. I ask you all to unite in finding the perpetrator who did this, Milligan Boat, an experienced Irish setter and Afghan hound kennel owner who has officiated at Crufts, told reporters. Although she said that the autopsy showed that the poisoning must have taken place at Crufts, she refused to point the blame at rivals. Jagger died at his co-owner's home in Belgium, and some British newspapers have speculated that it might have been the victim of mistaken identity, as a half-brother, Pot Noodle, is another successful show dog. Owners flocked to the cavernous conference center outside Birmingham for Crufts, entering their pedigree dogs against 21,500 others in a series of competitions that culminate in Best of Show. A Scottish Terrier from Russia won that title 2 days after Jagger's death. The show was founded by Charles Cruft, who worked for a dog biscuit manufacturer. Winners, which emerge from the categories such as toy dogs, gun dogs, hounds, and terriers, often have striking names. A poodle called Afterglow, Maverick Saber, and also known as Ricky, won Best in Show. That's just appalling that, you know, someone would, kill a dog. You know, I guess if they were pointing to, you know, a Scottish Terrier from Russia, it's possible that might have been, you know, Putin's dog, because that seems to be the way he solves certain kinds of problems. Right now, you know, we are trying to contact our second guest, Todd Elliott, who is an author, and has written really a really interesting book. You know, I have to say, I don't often read all the books of the authors that, you know, I interview on the show, but I read this one just because of the title was pretty compelling, called Axes of Evil. And what it basically is about is apparently a series of serial killings, you know, that, you know, occurred at the turn of the century from roughly 1911 through, I guess, 1917 through the, I guess you could call it the Southwest, Louisiana, Texas, and one case up in Iowa. And what's startling about these particular cases and horrific was that they weren't individual victims. Entire families were killed in their sleep with a poleaxe, and oftentimes the poleaxe was left, left behind. Now, you know, apparently, you know, well, because this was, at the time it was, you know, there was no CSI, you know, so nobody could, you know, check for fingerprints. I don't even think there were, I know there weren't fingerprints at the time, these crimes have basically gone unsolved while suspects were, you know, arrested and rounded up at various points. When these crimes were committed, one of the things that would throw police off is when they thought they had the quote-unquote axe man, as it was referred to by the folks in these areas, thought they had captured him and he was incarcerated, you know, yet another murder would occur. So they would know that, they didn't have, the actual person. And, this is really kind of an interesting thing. I mean, Todd does have and talks about in his book his theories as to who really committed these crimes. And if we get him on the show, I'll let him tell you. But I guess Steve is shaking his head and telling me that we don't have him.
Things so, don't always work out on the Surreal News as we thought. You know, yes, maybe we can get him on another time.
I know.
We are planning some shows coming up, and let me tell you that also we do have some concerts coming up tonight. We have Bird Tribe Envision. That's tonight at the Fogartyville Media and Arts Center, and that is Friday, March 13th. That's tonight at 8 o'clock, and this says, I think it says $5 here, and we encourage everybody to come out. Fogartyville Media and Arts Center is directly behind the WSLR studio, and that's at 525 Kumquat here in the downtown Sarasota area, and we want to encourage everybody to come out and join us for that. And you're listening to WSLR. Remind everybody, this is 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station. And I also want to encourage people to listen to other talk shows. For example, we have Stratosphere Sarasota, which is on alternate Wednesdays from 9 to 9:30, a science and social science show with Nancy Norris, who's my wife, and I co-host that show with her. That's on, and other great shows as well.
Okay, I have some other news, Steve. If we want to talk about that, because like I said, I mean, we'll save Todd's revelations about the axes of evil for another time.
Let's also mention just before you get to that news, we are in contact with Christine Jennings, who should be on our show, and remind people Christine Jennings did run for Congress. She lost by a hair, and there were a bunch of missing votes there, and that was sort of suspect. That's Vern Buchanan is currently sitting in that seat that we feel was stolen from her. She is now going to be the head of the Democratic Party of Sarasota.
She has been named the chair of the Democratic Party.
And she's going to be joining us most likely, we're hoping, for in a couple weeks.
A couple weeks. Hopefully the 27th is going to work. She has indicated to me that she would like to be back on the show, because she was on the show once before, predated my time here with you, Steve.
She has been on the show. She's a friend of the show.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
also, let me just mention, we have our remote reporter in New Jersey, and that's Lou Manzo. And he's been sending me information about Chris Christie. He's been on our show several times. He wrote a book about the rise and fall of Chris Christie. And the latest emails that he's been sending me, he's been dying to get back on this show, and we are going to have him back on, has to do with Exxon and the state of New Jersey. And what happened is there was a lawsuit, and Exxon lost this lawsuit to the tune of over $12 billion for all the sludge and all the foul smell that's going on in New Jersey. And that lawsuit has been going on over several administrations, and it was just reported recently that the $12 billion under Chris Christie was reduced to $250 million for all this damage.
Wow.
And there are some questions that we have as to how this occurred under the Christie administration, some backdoor deals, and we should get Lou Manzo back on our show within a week or two to tell us some of the backdoor deals that are going on, how $12 billion got reduced to $250 million by Chris Christie. And Chris Christie has a history of using lawsuits against companies to fund his political campaign by reducing the fines against companies with the agreement that they would then contribute to his own personal campaign. We have evidence of that from the past. We wonder, is that what's going on here with his presidential campaign here?
Well, actually, you know, it wasn't, I think, you know, as Lou told us, it wasn't really that direct a line. What he basically does is, you know, gets these guys, fined or under some sort of compliance order, but they have to use the attorneys that he picks, and then they have to pay the attorneys, and then it's the attorneys that end up contributing part of that money to his campaigns.
Okay,
you know?
They're correction.
So,
thank
so that's,
you.
That's kind of the way. Well, that's the way it worked in the past.
Yeah, we can ask Lou about that.
I want Lou Manzo to tell Lou how that works.
All right, so you have a story. Anybody else you want to mention that's coming up? We have lots of things. This is a busy, busy year for us on the Surreal News here.
You know, we're looking into a few things, but really kind of not really.
And just mention, I was at the EcoFest, and we're around town. If you're interested in joining WSLR as a volunteer, you can do that. You can call 894-6469, become a volunteer. You can come to our shows and meet people here. You can even, if you're interested, have your own show. We've had some guests come through, and then eventually I've had their own shows. Well, like you, Lou. You
That's right. I was a guest originally.
And now you've got your show here with me here. And we want to encourage everybody. Just this is your community radio station, and you're welcome to be involved.
That's right. And it is a great experience. And one of the great experiences now, I know there are a lot of people that listen to this station who are writers or literate people, and there is a Maine innkeeper who is going to give away her idyllic country inn, which is valued at around $905,000, to the winner of an essay contest that she launched earlier this year. Applicants must be eager to run the business and convey their qualifications in an impeccably crafted but spare 200-word essay to the owner of Central Lovett Inn and Restaurant, Janice Sage said. Sage, who first launched her campaign in January on Facebook, said in an interview that she aims to garner as many as 7,500 paid submissions by May 17th. The $125 per entry fee would be enough to cover the estimated value of the 210-year-old facility, plus an additional $20,000 for the next owner. There are a lot of talented people out there that can't go out and buy an inn like this, she said. Now, all they need to do is write and convince me. The hotel, together with a barn, was built in 1875 with other outbuildings and is located about 55 miles northwest of Portland and offers sweeping views of New Hampshire's snow-capped mountains. Sage, who has run the inn for 22 years, will select the top 20 essays, then pass them on to two unnamed local residents to judge the finalists and select the winner. There is some fine print. The winner, Sage says, must agree to operate the business for 1 year following transfer of ownership, and will keep the inn painted its traditional white with green or black roofing and shutters. Even the idea of the contest is rooted in tradition, she said. Sage herself took ownership
of the
'93 after she won a similar essay contest launched by the previous owner. You know, Steve, that is true.
And it's a great story. And when
I first read the headline and I saw it, you know, I said, boy, I've heard this story before. I think this has happened before. And, of course, I got down to the bottom and I said, well, yeah, it's the same place.
When she originally won it, I heard an interview with her. She said she had no inkling that she was going to win it. She was told, she was like, really? And then she went and then she ran this in.
Ran this in Maine. And well, you know, I think it's worth a little bit more now than it probably was when she won it. But, you know, I wish her the best of luck, you know. I mean, she's running it for 22 years. I guess it's time to retire.
Yes, that apparently so.
You know, especially with all the snow they're getting up there. It's time to get the heck out of Dodge or New England.
Yes. All right, so let me just mention just a few other news items that we sort of glanced over before, that John Kerry was calling out Florida for their ban on saying climate change, what we say here is global dying. So Secretary of State John Kerry challenged climate change deniers to face reality, calling out Florida Governor Rick Scott's administration on Thursday for banning the term climate change from all government communications. And, of course, we reported that we are the front line for global dying, what people are calling climate change, right here in Florida. And we don't have time to waste debating whether we can say climate change. That's what Kerry said. We have to talk about how to solve climate change. Yeah, I mean, how can you solve a problem if you can't talk about it? I mean, that just seems ridiculous.
Well, you know, I mean, you can be the ostrich and stick your head in the sand, but, you know, Governor Scott, you know, when your, you know, palatial mansion on the shores of Florida in Naples is 3 feet underwater, then perhaps you'll notice.
All right, so here's the quote. We have to talk about how to solve climate change, because no matter how much people want to bury their heads in the sand,
thank you,
Florida sand here, it will not alter the fact that 97% of peer-reviewed climate change studies confirm that climate change is happening and that human activity is largely responsible. Also, the ban also extends to the term global warming, and that was reported by Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Scott declined to say whether that was true or not. And, of course, his comment is that he's not convinced by the science, and then he also says he's not a scientist.
Well, that's a standard answer when anybody asks him about him. I am not a scientist. You know, and also, too, I mean, I like the idea they like to refer to, you know, sea levels rising as nuisance flooding. I would call that a nuisance, you know, when I walk out my front door and there's like water splashing
and these
up
the same people
it. That's kind of a nuisance.
That see, you know, like snowfall and think that that's proof that there's no global warming, even though we've had one of the warmest years in the history of the planet Earth. Ouch. Yes, yes. All right, well, we're just about coming towards the end of our show, and we do have our complex waveforms coming up in a minute, so you don't want to touch that dial. That'll be Mark Zimpella coming up in a minute, and we'll get that ready. And we have some bumper music coming up in a minute, too. I produced and wrote this bumper music. That's our surreal music, which is coming up in just a couple of seconds right about now. And we want to invite everybody also to come to our shows which we have at Fogartyville. We've been telling you about those. Oh, there's some loud music for you there. And kudos to my co-host, and that is Lou Larini in the studio here. Thank you, Lou.
Thank you, Steve.
So you've heard a lot of news and views here. They're not those of WSLR, its volunteers, its board members, or its employees. Just of our fabulous guests, like Ambassador Chris Hill, the ambassador to Iraq just a few years ago.
I tell you, and I have to reiterate, that was one terrific interview. I learned a little bit, and I thought that was a great... He sounds like a really great guy.
He's been called the smartest diplomat.
Yeah.
Yeah, for good reasons. All right, so stay tuned. So let's see what Mark Zimpella has in store for us here. We have John Schofield, a go-go, And we're going to listen to the cut here, which is a go-go. And that's coming up in just about a minute. Bird Tribe Inversion.
It's Plus Inversion, I think.
Bird Tribe. Oh, Plus.
Plus Inversion.
I see. There was
a plus
sign
here at Fogartyville.
Tonight at 8.
Tonight
$5.
At 8.
Yeah,
that's
what a
right.
great.
There's always something here at Fogartyville. You guys
these,
really got to check
these concerts
out.
Are their best value, I'll tell you. And also, you get to meet the artists right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is fab. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your true community radio station and news and public affairs surreal news show, your weapon of mass instruction. All right, here we go. Some great music with Mark Zampella. Don't touch that dial.